The following interview was conducted on behalf of the Oral History Program of Century High School. Their interviewee is Rob Masser. The interviewer is the Chair Noise. The interview took place at Rob Masser's office in downtown Hillsboro on May 18th at 3 o'clock.
So our question, like, we're analyzing the crime, like the crime and law enforcement, like the changes over the past 25 years.
Uh-huh.
But we kind of wanted like a perspective on like how the budget is affecting that and like just a perspective like that.
So okay.
Just to start out, like, do you have anything you could say about that? Like just crime and law enforcement in Hillsboro?
Well, we, in the period you're talking about over the like last 20 years, okay. I've been with the city for 15 years, and when I came to the city, our law enforcement, we were providing about one sworn officer per 1,000 population. And that was, at that point in time, seemed to be adequate for the level of crime and the activity in Hillsboro. Of course, back then, Hillsboro was probably less than 40,000 people. And then about 1996, 97, it became apparent that we were falling further and further behind in keeping up with crime-related activities. And so we entered into a program looking at service levels in the police department, and went to the voters with a package that looked at increasing our police protection. Street crimes unit, in patrol, in detectives, and just increasing our police force in general to keep up with the increase in our crime and the increase in population, because we were seeing, you know, increases in population of 4,000 to 5,000 per year. So in 1998, we took that to the voters, and they voted 70% yes. And so in 1999, we started collecting more property tax to hire more officers and built up the force. Since that time, in the last 15 years, we've just about doubled the size of the police force today. And some would say we're still starting to slip behind a little bit, because there's just such an increase in activity just in general in the city as it grows and becomes more dense.
So what exactly are your specific responsibilities as a city manager?
Well, I'm actually the assistant city manager, and my specific responsibilities, although broad and just in general city management, but specifically I oversee all of the support services, which would be finance and capital development and human resources and purchasing. I work with police and fire and the water department, Parks and Recreation, but I pay close attention to the support services. I'm also the budget officer, which means I'm the one that puts the budget together, looks at service levels in all those different departments, works with the departments to determine where we'd like to be and what it will take to support those levels of service, and then put together a budget and then present that to the public and to the budget committee, which is our council and some and seven members of just in general of Hillsborough, and present that, and then they would be either adopted or not. But I'm responsible for that process too.
All right. So, how have you seen like the needs in budget, like where how you delegate the money? You know, like mm-hmm. how you delegate who gets money. How's it changed over time? Like, does one specific group need more now? Or?
That's real interesting. That's a good question. And in fact, we track that. We call that allocation of resources in the general fund. So we will look at the total general fund we're talking about right now. General fund is the fund that provides police service, fire service, libraries, and parks and recreation. There's some other things like street lighting, but those are the four main departments in the general fund. The general fund is about 62% of the general fund is funded through property tax, and then the rest is through fees and charges and those sorts of things. So what we do is we'll track the percentage of the total resources in the general fund and where they go to each one of those departments to see whether there's a shift in the allocation of those resources from one department to the other. And in fact, they've remained relatively even over the last 5, 6, 7 years. It's been remarkably even in terms of its allocation to those departments. Really haven't changed much. There's a little shift to parks and recreation, a slight shift. You'll see parks and recreation taking a little bit more because we've grown a lot in parks and recreation. You see a little shift away from library, and we're only talking about a percentage point. There's minor changes there. Police and fire have remained pretty even in terms of the piece of the pie that they take. Now, this is all true since we went through that process, as I was just talking about before. Before we went through that process, it was very different. There was much more of the resources going to what was there then. Prior to 1999, more of the existing resources going towards park and recreation and library. So once we started what we call the local option tax, which funded this increase in police and fire, you see a much greater shift in around, right around 1999 and 2000. There was a big shift in funding to public safety, which is police and fire. But since then, it's been pretty even. now, that's only part of the story. Then there's all these other departments, as I mentioned, that for support services, which is, as I mentioned, human resources and finance, information services and capital planning and development and purchasing. And there has been a shift to a couple areas there. There's been a shift in information services has grown. In fact, when I came here 15 years ago, there wasn't even an information services department. Now we have 15, 16 people in the information services, and that's all our computers. That runs all of our computers, all of our programming, all of just the information services. And so that's grown tremendously. Technology has grown tremendously. And so the support of the technology and all those people that support it have grown in the last 15 years from nothing to about 18, 15, or 17 now. And that's new.
So, I read a quote online that you said, like, about how Intel's helped with the budget, like they made a donation, or can you talk about that? more about that.
Right. It wasn't a donation. Back in 1994-95, Intel Corporation was growing, and they were looking for places around the world to put their plants and their research and development and their chip manufacturing plants. That business is very capital intensive. That means that they have a tremendous amount of money and resources in the equipment in their plants. They're very unique in that way in business, because they'll have in a building, they'll have machines sitting around that are worth literally millions of dollars a piece. The state of Oregon's tax system is unique in the United States in many ways. And one of the unique points of the Oregon tax system is, for me as just a house owner, you're taxed on the value of your house, and that's it, the real property. In businesses in Oregon, they're taxed not only on the building, but the equipment and the stuff inside the building. So the tax assessor will figure out the value of all this equipment inside the building and then tax you on that. Well, that really is not significant for most any business, but for Intel, that's huge, because they may have $500 million worth of buildings, but they may have, $10 billion in equipment sitting inside of it. It's just extraordinarily expensive and valuable. So they just, at that point, they weren't interested in coming to Oregon or building their major facilities in Oregon, because it was just too expensive for them because of our tax system. Well, we recognized that and went down to the legislature and developed this thing called a strategic investment program. And the legislature adopted this program, and it's in state statute now. And what it allows us to do for a business like Intel — there's only a handful around the world that would be that size, and Intel's one of them — it allows us to negotiate a deal with them so we exempt the equipment inside their building, or at least bring its value way down for tax purposes. And that's what we did in 94. And they said, oh, great, okay, here's a new program. Maybe we could consider Oregon, because they like Oregon, they wanted to be here. And because of that new tax system that we were allowed to now negotiate with them what that property tax would be, they decided to build their plants. We just last night went through a next strategic investment program negotiation and had both the county and the city meet jointly to consider another strategic investment program with Intel, and it was passed last night, which basically ensures our future. They'll be here for — that's a 15-year program, and it allows them to invest. It allows them to invest up to $24 billion in Hillsboro. It's hard to understand how much money that is, but that is, it was said last night, and it's true, this is the largest deal in the United States, and probably the largest deal we'll see in the last decade in the entire United States happened last night. That's a huge deal. And then that allows us to negotiate this deal with them and the strategic investment program. So in lieu of them, instead of them paying property taxes on the full equipment, we don't tax them for the equipment inside the building, or not to the full degree. And in exchange for that, they make payments to the city and to the county. And that's called fee in lieu of tax. So they make those payments in lieu of tax. And this is by contract we negotiate with. Well, for us, they're making payments, we're getting about, we're estimating about $2 million a year in payments from them on this deal. Well, we found out earlier this year that those estimated payments of $2,000 a year actually are now increasing to probably over $3 million a year. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but it's basically the value of their buildings have risen to the point that it's increased way beyond what we thought we would be receiving from them. So we're receiving another $1.25 million from them this year and next year and as far out in the future as we can see. And that's what that quote was about. That was money that we were not anticipating receiving from Intel. And now it appears as though we will continue to receive. And so we made some choices on how to use that money. One of those was to help fund the general fund and police and fire with that money.
All right. So, is there a deficit in our spending at all?
It's in the last 2 years, yes. we had, through several years, had built up our reserves in the general fund. And we had a goal of being around what we call ending reserves funds are at least 15% of total expenditure in the general fund. So that was our goal, to get there. And we got beyond that. We got up actually a little bit above 20% in our reserves, which, I mean, is good in many ways. We're a bit conservative, and we built that reserve a little bit higher. So in the last couple of years, we've actually been drawing down that reserve a little bit. And it's estimated this year to be drawn down and actually dip a little bit below 15%. So we're going to need to watch that. We don't want to draw it down much more. But that's what that deficit is. We're actually spending a little bit more than we're bringing in revenue. And the difference is made up by drawing down some of those reserves. Now, we don't want to do that over time, and there are reasons why we are in that situation right now, and one of those is a long story, mm-hmm. and difficult to explain, but it actually does have to do with the high-tech sector. And like I said before, about 62-63% of our revenues in the general fund come from property tax. And for many, many years, that was increasing by 8-12% per year. And that was fairly consistent through the 90s and into 2000-2001. And the brakes were put on in 2002, and all of a sudden, that increase was 2.3%, which was the lowest in the county, and really surprised us, caught us by surprise. We were anticipating that conservatively to be around a 5.5-6% increase, and it actually went 2%. So, what ended up happening is revenues in that year, in 2002, didn't rise as much as we anticipated. Yet our expenditures were rising, and so those lines crossed, and our expenditures got a little bit higher than the revenues. That's happened over the last couple of years, where our increases in assessed value in property have been very low relative to other cities around us. And we've looked into that to understand what was going on, and we've discovered that it is specifically in the industrial sector that had significant decreases in value out there. This is outside of Intel and that SIP I was talking about, but the rest of the industrial sector in Hillsborough. Hillsborough is unique in that it has a high percentage of its value is in the high-tech sector. So we have a much higher percentage, being in Silicon Forest, and really this is the place for semiconductors, or really around the world. We have a high percentage of that value is in that area, and that area is subject to global markets. And when the high-tech global market had suffered in this recession in the last couple of years, so did the value of their equipment. And we felt that effect in the last couple of years. Now that's rebounding, that's starting to change and come back. And so those couple of years we've been operating, say, deficit, which is true, been drawing down those reserves, and that's why we have those reserves. We don't want to be in a position like many governments are, where you have to react to changes every year, and you're hiring people and you're firing people and you're laying them off. We don't want to do business that way. We want to be as efficient and effective as we can, and that's why, in part, why we have that reserve. And so this is an appropriate use of those reserves.
So how's the public taken all of this in? They understand that there's not really a problem?
Well, you'll always have a large section of the public not going to understand that. And I mean, that's just the nature of this business. These issues can be very complex, particularly when you get into the high-tech sector and you get into the State Department of Revenue and how they assess it, just what you were talking about. All of that is very, very, it becomes very complex and hard to understand. And it's hard to simplify it to a point where, you know, anyone that's not involved in that on a daily basis is getting ready to pick up and understand it. So there are misunderstandings out there, but there are those that don't fully understand. But for the most part, I think people have understood that we've operated the city government pretty efficiently and effectively. So I don't think that there's been too much of a backlash.
Have any of these deficits, or they're not really deficits yet, but have they affected the
No, I would say no. A deficit is not going to create more crime out there.
Right.
So the question is, are we able to keep up with the crime activity? If you ask a police officer, and I'll talk from my perspective, you'll ask a public safety officer, they'll tell you there's never enough police, ever. And that's true, because you're never going to solve all crime. It's always there. So the question is, what's the appropriate level of law enforcement? And we use a tool to measure as a guideline whether we are at that appropriate level or not. And what we use is called a Hobson model. And what it does is take a sworn officer, a gun-carrying cop on the street, and it tracks that officer's time. And we do this through our 911 dispatch center, which keeps the records, and then we analyze that. And what we do is break down to find out how much what we call committed versus uncommitted time that officer in the street has. And the committed time is the time that they're running from call to call, reacting to a call. And the uncommitted time is the time that they're not going from call to call, and they have time to do what we call community policing, or what we would call proactive labor. They will be doing crime prevention sorts of activities. They will be following up on other calls, finding out whether it was taken care of, doing the community policing, getting out of the public, doing all those other things than just running to a call, just responding to a call. So that's called uncommitted time, or proactive labor. And statistics would suggest that the sweet spot kind of is about 70% committed time and about 30% uncommitted time, or time to do all this other stuff. So The research would suggest that it's about 70 to 30. So we track that and see what's actually happening in our officers out there. And in fact, they have been running right around that 70 to 30. Depending on exactly how you measure it, you could argue that it's creeping up a little bit around 72-73% committed time. Well, that's still real close. So those numbers would tell us that generally we appear to be around the level we want to be. But again, you have to just use that as a guideline. You can't just look at those numbers and say we're fine. There's a lot of other things obviously that are involved in that. But that as a general guideline would suggest that we are still right there. Now, we were slipping a little bit, and that's why in this last budget session we're looking at trying to add two more officers.
Do you live in Hillsgrove?
I do not.
You've already said that Hillsborough, like, it's gotten larger. What else have you noticed over just the change since?
Oh, there's been a tremendous amount of change. I would say a transformation, a fundamental change in the city. Now, I'm actually born and raised in Portland, so known Hillsborough my whole life. Although I never lived in Hillsborough. And I think there's just been a fundamental change, and it's interesting if you look at the demographics of Hillsborough, they have changed dramatically. Hillsborough used to be a small, kind of a standalone town. That's why you have this downtown. It was far enough away from Portland to be kind of a standalone, very small town. And when I came here, there was still that very strong sort of, whatever you want to call it, good old boy system, you know, the long-standing Hillsborough kind of power structure. And it's just exploded in growth in a unique way. It's exploded in growth in the high-tech. And the high-tech has attracted young, highly educated, highly mobile people. It's a very different sort of influx. And so, as was mentioned last night in some of the testimony, it was actually the manager of the streets at Tannisbourne. Have you ever been to the streets at Tannisbourne?
Yep.
She manages all of them, and she was talking about saying, you know, from day one, that is 100% leased out, that entire thing. So it's so far outpaced what they thought it could be that those operations there, those restaurants, are the highest producers in the state already. And she said that it is because of Hillsborough's high tech and that influx. You have a very, if you look at the average person that lives in Hillsborough, they have a higher level of education than you would normally see. They have a higher income than you would normally see. And they're younger than you would normally see. And all of those are really good for the things like the P.F. Chang's and the macaroni grills and just all the stuff that you pull to grill, all that stuff going on that you see. So it's a very different thing. It's also, we just did a study, real interesting, you might be interested in this. It was called the Young and Restless Study. And it was done nationwide to look at, and the theory is that those that are aged between 25 and 35 years old are the highest educated, are the most mobile, and are the most creative. And so the theory is that whatever area, metropolitan area, is attracting that age group is ensuring its future, because they are ensuring the most highly educated, the most creative age group. That age group actually, in total, has decreased by 10% in the last decade as the baby boomers get older. So 25 to 35 has actually decreased by 10%. But when we studied nationwide, there were four areas in the nation that were attracting that age group. And Portland was one of them. And Portland's, that age group in the last decade, that age group has increased by 50% in Portland, where overall it's decreased by 10%. So they're moving to Portland. They're moving to Portland, they're moving to Austin, Texas. They're moving to Raleigh, Durham area. I don't know why, and I'm forgetting the last one. But that's where they're going. So we looked at that and started wondering, why is that? Why are they coming here? And so we did some study in Hillsborough to find out, you know, did some focus groups with that age group to find out what, you know, how engaged they are with the city and the activities. And what you find is they like the high tech and the things that are going on, but they're not necessarily engaged with kind of the old Hillsborough, the downtown, and those sorts of things. So there is a kind of a disconnect in some ways with those that have moved here, particularly as you go east into the Tannersville area, that maybe don't even know that they're in Hillsborough. They don't even know that they live in. We see a lot of that. Back to, just had a Bugatti's restaurant open up in, over by the streets of Tannersville, and they went to Beaverton to get a business license, and Beaverton gave them one business license to do business in Hillsborough. They didn't know they were in Hillsborough. So I mean, there's that sort of thing going on, and I think that is a huge change.
Because that's like right around the corner from my house.
Yeah. Are you right over by streets?
Right.
Yeah. But that's what we thought was so funny, is not only did they go to Beaver to get a business license, which is funny enough, but the city of Beaver gives them one. Like, they don't even know. You know, so, you know, how do you expect a person lives over there that's got a Beaverton address? Because the address, the post office, mm-hmm. works in a very different system. So you might have a Beaverton address, or you might even have a Portland address, but you actually live in the city of Hillsborough. So it's that sort of identity crisis, I think, that has changed.
So you talk about like the age group kind of being young. Do you see like ethnicity mixed in that?
Yes, like, absolutely. That came out, and that was really interesting in the focus group. I sat in one, they had 15 to 20 in that age group, and they were mostly from the high-tech sector, but It was a very interesting mix. I mean, just an entire mix of different nationalities. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to, you know, a woman from Africa, a guy from, I mean, just they're from all around the world talking about Hillsborough and what they like about it. But having them coming from places like, you know, you think would be tremendous ethnic mix, saying Hillsborough feels like walking around the United Nations because there's so many different cultures that are here now. I mean, that's what they were saying, that they were shocked at how diverse it is in terms of the different different cultures that are here.
Did they like that?
Yeah, that was real positive.
What other positive things did they say?
They liked, well, there's a lot of things like it. They liked the vitality, they liked just all the things that Oregonians love, you know, it's the environment, it's, you know, it's being, you know, an hour from the beach,
right.
And being an hour from, you know, the mountains, going to the desert, you know, living in a city that many, many years ago figured out about this urban growth boundary, you know, and kept growth contained and not sprawled like Atlanta or Los Angeles or San Francisco, or just the traditional sort of model, American city just grows. Portland figured that out in the early 60s and drew a line around it and said, you're not going to grow outside of it. You're going to grow within it, but you're not going to grow outside. So that's why, looking out these windows, you see all of this.
Mm-hmm.
You look all around, you look out in the hills, and that is all outside the urban growth boundary. And so there's this feeling, and you can live, I'll drive to work in literally country roads,
right.
and you're in a major metropolitan area. I mean, that's just very unique. It's that they love. It's the diversity, which is interesting. They will say they love the diversity, but when you really start asking, what does that mean? Because to me, that means diversity in ethnic, races and background. And they don't necessarily mean that. What they mean is diversity like in neighborhoods, diversity in independent businesses and restaurants. There's a feeling, it's kind of a frontier feeling. They'll say, I feel like I can be a part of shaping a community. It's not like I'm moving to a place that's already done.
Mm-hmm.
It's already been done. I just live there. They feel like they're a part of shaping something new. It's like a new frontier. You hear that sort of thing. And that's what they love about it. Plus, you can live here reasonably. It's not too expensive to live here. And there's just all the things you can get to in a matter of a couple hours. And there are good jobs. I mean, it's all of that. We just had, Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
Yahoo's down in Silicon Valley. And they searched to move their business. They searched around the United States, had many, many, they had 28 cities they looked at. They ended up announcing that they chose Hillsborough. So they're moving here. And we worked with them to try to make that decision. And they were planning on moving just a section of Yahoo to whatever city they decided on. They decided here in Hillsborough. And they were planning on moving 90 of their employees, their top educated employees. And when the word got out down there that they chose Hillsborough, they had 300 people come say, we want to go there. We want to move. And so now they're moving like 300 people because their business, they all want to be here.
So we talked about like what they liked about Hillsborough. Anything stand out on top that they didn't like?
Yes. Very clearly. They complain about the traffic. But, that's not all that unique. Metropolitan areas, but they will complain about the traffic. They will complain about the lack of choice in housing stock. And this is an interesting one. Portland has developed this model of high density. And so if you look around at all the new houses and stuff, they're all built on these little tiny lots. They're all tiny lots. You don't build larger lots like you see virtually everywhere else. And that's all fine, but that's all that's being built. That's it. There's no diversity, there's no choice in new stuff, really, unless you want to spend millions and millions of dollars. And so you'll hear complaints about a lack of choice in diverse housing stock, is what it's called, different types of, sizes of lots. But the most important thing, and this is what I heard loud and clear over and over again, is we will complain about traffic. We will complain about lack of diversity in housing stock. We will leave because of the schools. That was number one. The rest of those things are complaints and annoyances, but they said, we will leave about the schools if you don't figure that one out.
So what changes have you made to figure that out?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of control over that.
Right.
We've got to figure that one out. That is number one. You just cannot have a vital community, a place that people want to be, and destroy your school system. The two don't work.
Especially since everyone here, you said, is really highly educated, so they're going to want
absolutely
to keep that going.
Right. So we have got to figure that one out. And it really scares me because we're knocking on the door of really tearing down that system. If we don't figure that one out, it's going to be too late. Look around you. Go down. Go to Los Angeles. Go to San Francisco. Go to, you know, look at what our future could be. And there's a system where it just was neglected, and now it's failed. And there's just, I don't see any way back from that. I don't know how you build up something that you've allowed to fail. And we've always had strong support of schools in the past, and had a very good public school system. But we're starting to knock on the door of neglecting and ignoring, or letting it fall apart. I think that's real dangerous. If we go through that door, I don't think there's any coming back. Or it's very, very difficult to come back. And those that are moving here or coming here will tell you that. Which is interesting, because we're still not getting the votes to fund the schools, and so I don't know what the disconnect there is. I think people generally want to believe that it's, you know, it's inefficiency, or it's somebody else's problem, or I want all this, but I shouldn't have to pay for it. The hard fact is, it's expensive, and you gotta, you know, if you want it, you gotta pay for it.
So overall, in general, do you view Hillsborough as a safe place to live?
Absolutely.
All right. So I guess that's all I have to say, unless there's anything else you can add.
Well, so the general kind of thing is, sounds like public safety.
Right.
Safety. Well, I guess I'd say again, it is education, it is the school systems, because, you know, if you don't pay for it now, you will pay for it later in public safety. That this is a perfect example of prevention. And we understand that in so many other areas, but we just don't seem to understand it in this area. And we understand prevention. We're starting to understand prevention in medicine now, that you spend a dollar in preventative medicine, that right now we're seeing about $1.65 return from that dollar we spend in trying to make our employees healthier. Have healthier habits, those sorts of things. So we have a health promotion program, and we've recognized that we spent a dollar in trying to encourage that, and in terms of savings, we get about $1.65 back. So there's an example of prevention. We see it in crime and other in other areas, but in education, I mean, if you allow that system, that basic education system, to fall apart, you're going to pay for it in a big way, in a very different way. It's going to be down the line. It's going to be in crime. It's going to be in ignorance. It's going to be in, you know, in all the sorts of things that are just extremely expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So that scares me.